delightful day. I was expecting three, so 20 or 30 is just wonderful, right? If I wasn't so bound to these, you know, images and things up here, we could just do a little walking talk or something. That's okay. I hope you all get outside after this. My name is Jason, for those I haven't met yet. I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. I teach theology. And had this great chance this week to start five different conversations. This one's going to be about Christian-Jewish relations, and I'm going to introduce a term called supersessionism. See if you can work it in on your lunchroom table. Supersessionism. It's a pretty technical term, but I think what it means actually is something we know, or at least we intuit it, or we've seen it, we can recognize it. The theme for this whole week for my series of discussions has been Becoming a Christian in Christendom, and that's a kind of generic title for thinking about ways that Christians might hang on to their particular identity and not kind of fade into the general North American majority culture. And I think it's real danger in some ways, because Christianity is the predominant religion this time and this place. It's easy for us to think we're everything and nothing, kind of like straight white males have trouble thinking of themselves in those categories. I think Christians sometimes have trouble thinking of themselves as something and not just the norm, something particular, peculiar, and not just the norm, right? And those Buddhists, those are the ones who are odd, right? We're not odd. I think Christians should be odd. We should claim our oddity, our particularity. And so these are different ways of getting into that. And this one, this conversation, I think, is the oddball out in some ways. It's not immediately clear, maybe at the beginning, about how this is about Christian identity, but maybe by the end we can return to that, and I can make a case, or we can make a case for why it is about Christian identity. If you all have trouble hearing, please move forward. I know we're going to have some electricians over here and airplane flyers, I think, out there with great laughter. Or just tell me to crank it up, or tell one another.
May I ask a quick question?
Please.
Sorry. Because of the bus, but have you explained supersessionism?
No,
yet?
I have not. Only to say that it's a point of mouthful, is it? So we're going to do that first. Undefining supersessionism. Thank you for the transition. I think it's helpful. We're talking supersessionism is one way to talk about Christian interpretations of Judaism that might not be as healthy as they could be. But I want to define it right away from two other terms that we're more familiar with. Anti-Semitism, of course, we hear all the time. Anti-Judaism, sometimes these are synonymous. They're used interchangeably. But I would say anti-Semitism really comes around in the late 19th, early 20th century, where Jewish people are thought of as a race, and that you can identify them through their blood, their lineage. In the same way that African Americans in this country, slaves, right, if you have an ounce of blood, African blood, you're considered a slave, or, you know, trying to be identified by a race as a Semitic people. Of course, there's other Semitic people other than the Israelites, of course. Anti-Judaism, I think we want to say, is a theological category. That doesn't make it better, but it's a negative impression of Jewish people based on their religion, not based on their race. Of course, those two overlap, and it's really, really hard to separate them. Who a Jewish person is really hard to define. Some would say you're Jewish if your mother is Jewish. That's what being Jewish is. Others say there's practicing Jews, non-practicing Jews. It's about a religion. Hard to separate. Supersessionism is a form of anti-Judaism, a particular form of anti-Judaism. In other words, it's a theological interpretation of Jewish people from a Christian point of view. It's not a racial interpretation. In other words, it's not a racist way of thinking, but it's a particular theological way of thinking. I think these distinctions are really important as we get going, because I'm gonna say that many of us, including myself, maybe myself at the top of the list, are prone to supersessionistic ways of thinking, and I hope people don't hear that as, ooh, someone's calling me an anti-Semitic person, or charging me with racism, bigotry. I don't think. It's very subtle kinds of ways of thinking that we've been trained into, And one of the opportunities we have is to unlearn some patterns of thinking, if we find that important. I haven't yet defined what this is, by the way, but is that where you were?
It's kind of like, where does the word sessionism
come from? Yeah, good, let's get there. Supersessionism literally means to sit upon or to supersede or replace. So supersessionism, if you want to say supersedism, that would be just another even more awkward way of translating it. But it's the understanding that Christianity as a religion sits upon the Jewish religion, and in sitting upon it, it replaces it or displaces it as its role as God's chosen people. So Judaism is good, healthy, important until the time of Christ. God uses the Israelites, calls the people, has a plan, has a covenant. But once Christianity comes, Christians have a new covenant with God through Jesus, and Judaism is done away with, is replaced by the new church. In other words, the Christian church becomes the new Israel in such a way that the old Israel should go away, pass away, be done with, be displaced by it, right? I'm going to make a case that many of us are deeply formed in these kinds of habits of thinking. And when we are, we don't know what to do with contemporary Jews, right? It's easy for us to make sense of the Israelites of the Old Testament. Those are the folks that play a great part in God's plan of salvation until Jesus comes. But we don't know what to do with our Jewish neighbors, our brothers and sisters in our communities. Because we think with the dawn of Christianity, that special role for Judaism should go away. And we're bothered when it doesn't. Now, I'm not pointing fingers, of course. I mean, we very large culturally, maybe as a church, but more even pervasive as a society. We're prone to these habits of thinking. At one point in our conversation, I'd like you to name some of the ways that we are prone to this habit of thinking. You might speak personally. You certainly wouldn't have to. Think about society, how we think about Judaism as that which should go away when Christianity comes on the scene. I'm going to quickly distinguish a few forms of supersessionism. Well, before that, let me pause. Does the concept make sense, this way of thinking? Yeah. Christianity supersedes Judaism in such a way that Judaism should go away when Christianity comes on the scene. It sits upon and so displaces or replaces it, or should.
Just recently, I got some DVDs on Judaism, and I was really impressed by the fact that Judaism has changed dramatically just after Christ, when the temple was destroyed.
Yeah, right.
All of a sudden, all these Levites and priests and so on are out of work, they're unemployed. They went to a synagogue system, and rabbis, instead of having this animal sacrifices, which they always had, and I just wondered, when I heard this, I said, well, maybe God is sending a message. You know, like when the Babylonians came and destroyed the first temple, and then took people in captivity because of their wickedness. Is it possible that God was using the Romans to say, hey, you guys are missing the boat here, that we sent the Messiah, he's here, and you should follow him. And because you can't offer sacrifices at the temple anymore. It's gone. Within 40 years, you know, crucifixion. And have you heard this before? It just occurred to me.
Yeah, no, I think that's a kind of common logic, and I think it taps into a supersessionistic logic. And again, I don't mean by saying that, wagging the fingers, that that's wrong. I'm prone to that kind of thinking too. And I shouldn't say, I mean, some will want to make a case that this is an okay logic, that as Christians we should think of Christianity displacing Judaism. I'm going to push in the other direction a little bit and say we really should be thinking about Judaism on its own terms and thinking about our identity not as displacing that identity, but evolving alongside of it. So another way to go back to where you started talking, another way to think about the birth of rabbinic Judaism is that Judaism isn't the mother that gives birth to Christianity, right, in such a way that the mom or dad has to die and now, you know, we take over, Christians take over, carry the torch. But rabbinic Judaism, which happens at the same time as the birth of Christianity, when the temple is destroyed in 70 of the Common Era, or year of our Lord, AD, when the temple's destroyed, that temple is no longer the center of Jewish life and practice. And now the synagogue is, and the rabbi, the moral teaching of the rabbis, are the center of that life. In some ways, you can see Judaism and Christianity, contemporary Judaism and contemporary Christianity, as coming out of the same event, the same time, and they're running kind of parallel. We're more like brothers and sisters, I would say, as the old mother, the old father, and the new religion. But it depends on how you define Judaism as well. Rabbinic Judaism is very different than what happens in the temple before 70 to come there. That's a great comment.
The whole thing was this animal sacrifice.
Yeah.
And Christ was the final Lamb of God. And then the Jews took off at an angle, it seems like.
Yeah. And well, so does Christians. Well, a different angle. Yeah. We'll come back. Yeah, it's good. There's a lot of ways I think we'll disagree here, which is good. Let me name just a couple of differences here. Punitive would be the most overt form of supersessionism. This is the understanding that because Jews were the ones who crucified Jesus, God takes back God's covenant to the Jews. So, well, you were my people, we had a covenantal relationship, but because you murdered my son, all bets are off. You're done, right? And we hear this, and that story plays out in some pretty malicious ways throughout Christian history, with accusing Jews of all sorts of crimes and the charge of deicide, that they killed God, Jesus as Son of God, is a really harsh, harsh charge, right? So you deserve to have the promises of God withheld from you because you turn your back on God.
How do people who say that deal with the atonement?
Are they psychotic?
That's nice to say to people who are psychotic.
There's always been a bit of double talk, I think. On the one hand, you're to blame for crucifying Jesus. On the other hand, that was necessary that happens for atonement. And there's a good degree. There's a good degree of double talk whenever you talk about atonement, right? Is this something bad, but good, but bad?
But I apologize for the psychotic statement.
Jews have paid a particular harsh price in that. They only get the bad side of it, right? You're not acting with God here in this drama. You're the bad guys. You killed God, and so your covenant has been withdrawn. So it's a very overt form of this. More subtly, I'm going to talk mainly about economic supersessionism and a little bit about structural, and we'll get there. I promise we're going to have a lot of time for conversation. Let me just get some of this out on the table. Here's what I think is just a kind of a deep logic, okay? And this is a logic I grew up with. I grew up in the Missouri Synod Church and then the ELCA, and I heard this. I don't know if it were people saying this in particular or me growing up and pulling bits and pieces from different things and kind of absorbing it. But this would be a kind of Christian interpretation of Judaism that leads into supersessionistic ways of thinking. The logic goes something like this. Judaism is old, right? Christianity is new. Now, in some sense, that's true. Judaism goes back further than Christianity, but again, it depends on how you define the word. Modern Judaism is actually just as new as Christianity, if not a little sooner. Pretty coterminous, that synagogues are happening, are budding up at the same time that the Christian communities are budding up, and they're all Jews, originally. The first Christians are Jews, and rabbinic Judaism is another way to be Jewish. Christianity is new and improved, the logic kind of goes. Judaism is about the law in a legalistic sense, not a full sense, not the Torah as the life-giving presence of God, right? You know this, Jewish people don't talk about the Torah as a legalistic thing, oh, we gotta follow the Torah, right? No, the Torah is God's gift to God's people and guidance for daily living, it's grace. But a Christian logic might say, Jews only have the law, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, but Christians have a word of grace or about love. This is very legalistic wooden. This is very personalistic, right? We don't have words written on a tablet. We have a living spirit of the living God, right, as seen in Jesus. Again, might be some truth to that, but if it's starkly proposed like that, you can see how the Jewish religion is always at the wrong end of the stick, right? Judaism is about external observance. It's ritualistic in a kind of formulaic ways, right? Jews do these certain things. They have to follow the letter of the law. And Christianity is more about internal belief. It's not these actions that we perform, rote, but It's what we believe. We have faith, again, in a kind of more personal way. Judaism thinks God is judgmental. Christianity thinks God is forgiving. Now, that's really, really stark, right? And many of us in the room would say, no. We've read our Bible. That's not the way. But when I survey or I teach my students, undergraduate students, I think that this, if these 18 to 21-year-olds are an example, this is a pretty common way of thinking about the Bible, that the first three quarters of the Bible has an angry, wrathful God who's always smiting people, right? And then along comes Jesus and God is forgiving. Of course, we know in the early church, one of the first things that Christians had to decide is what do we do with the Bible, with the Hebrew scriptures? The Bible was the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures. What do? We get rid of that and just collect these letters from Paul and these gospels, and that's now our Bible, pretty thin one. It'd be easier, right? All we have to read that. And they said no, that we believe that the God who's revealed through Jesus is the God of the patriarchs, is the God of Moses and Abraham, and that that same God is revealed here and revealed again here. And God isn't bipolar either, right? God is judgmental, and God is merciful from beginning to end in the Bible. So that one at least doesn't hold. This one's interesting. Judaism is a religion of the body. We said some people will say a Jewish person is a person whose mother is Jewish, right? You become Jewish not by a kind of faith or creed, but because you're born into this family, right? That Judaism is about a family, a biological family that you're born into, and that it's really about the here and now in a bodily form, where Christians sometimes think of our religion as a religion of the spirit, much more language of afterlife, about faith, belief, not our bodies. Of course, we should catch ourselves here and say we don't want to give up on the body. That's one of the ways that thinking through the problem of supersessionism might help Christians catch us in some faulty logic. In Judaism, God elects Abraham's offspring. It's a preferential love. God chooses or elects a particular people to play a particular role in God's plan, providential plan. Whereas often you hear in Christianity, God saves all regardless of family ties, right? God's love is universal or all-encompassing. There might be some truth to this. Certainly we find in the life and ministry of Jesus a kind of radically opening up of God's promises to Samaritans and women and tax collectors, right? But I too will try to make a case that we may not want to fully give up this God who works not just with a kind of blanket love, I love all y'all, as we say in the South, right? I love all y'all. But a God who works in particular ways, right? Who elects these people, and all will be blessed through them. We might think of Jesus, too, as electing this one, right? Jesus rises out of the waters at baptism. You are my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased, right? This particular love. Why this Palestinian Jew? Why not that one? I don't know. God loves this one. You're my son. And through you all will be blessed. We ought not give up on this particular love. We might even think of it as a kind of romantic love, right? I don't love my wife like I love all y'all. You should hope I don't. For your sake and hers, right? Maybe God's love is like that too.
I was
thanks.
Thinking in Judaism, Abraham was promised that by him all the nations of the world would bless
right.
themselves.
Right, right.
And so it's not just the Jews.
Right, and that's a great thing, a great qualification. This preferential love doesn't mean everyone else is left out. It means there's a certain order. I'm going to elect Israel, and through Israel, all the nations will be blessed. So Jews think of themselves not as we're on the in, you're on the out, but we are called to play a particular role in God's love, and it's through God's election of us that that love spreads outward. Christians might think of themselves as the next ring in that concentric circle, right? Jews to Christians to all in some ways. Great.
Over here.
Thanks.
If you extend this to its logical end, there's another problem with supersessionism, which is that if we as Christians believe that we could supersede the Old Testament Judaism, then we got to believe that somebody else could supersede us. And I'm guessing that would be far more controversial. And there's even, you know, I'm only guessing about who's in this room, but there are Mormons, there are Jehovah's Witnesses, there are much younger religions than
Islam?
Your basic, yes, right. Christianity. and all those groups would probably have some type of supersessionism going on in their thinking too.
Yep. Like last night, somebody let the cat out of the bag, you know, the final punch. So we're all done here. Thanks for coming.
No, I'm just kidding.
That's profound and wonderful, and we're going to return to it at the end. And you could say it maybe a little more at that time, too. Yeah, I think that there's a fundamental irony here, that if we believe we've superseded Jews, who's going to supersede us? We can't believe in a God who would take back God's promises. Because we believe our promises are here to stay as well. Yeah, let's come back to it. I didn't mean to. It's just wonderful. Yeah, and it's where we're headed, I think. So we'll keep circling around it. Thanks. One more here, logic of supersessionism. Judaism only knows the problem. They might know disobedience and sin, right? This goes along with, it's about the law. It shows how bad we are. And finally, Christianity is the answer. Knows the solution. God through Jesus saves sinners. So Jews are those seekers who are looking for redemption, and Christians are those who have found redemption. There might be value of taking those together in both ways. Jews certainly have an answer. They have the Torah, which is God's promise. They have covenant. They have election. They have grace and mercy. So they don't just have the problem and need a solution. And Christians, too, we often think of, we have the solution. That's true. But we have a thing like a promised second coming. Right, we have a way of the cross where it's not as though we're fully redeemed. We struggle through things here. We expect with hope a more full redemption that we only hear the creation groaning towards. Maybe this easy division of problem and answer needs to kind of get closer together. We're both religions who struggle towards something still promised, and are religions who already know what the fulfillment of that promise will look like. Through the person and death and resurrection of Jesus, through God's covenant and the Torah, and the life of the Jewish people. Any other comments at this point?
Yeah, one for me.
What's that?
If David is the symbol of the people of God, comparing to Jesus, the human manifestation of what it's all about.
Say more. Are you saying they're close or they're not?
No, I'm saying look at the issue. I mean, David exemplifies the human struggles of humanity.
Uh-huh. Right.
And Jesus shows us what's really potential.
Yeah.
Quite a dramatic difference.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to say that Judaism and Christianity are the same by any means. I think one of the problems with supersessionism is we actually think of them as too close, right? If one could displace the other, they're kind of like functionally equivalent. That's a bad word to use at 11:15, a beautiful place like this. But they're right, they're doing the same thing. So if you have one, why have another? I want to actually say, no, there's some really different things going on here, and that we should appreciate Judaism on its own terms. And that might allow us to appreciate our particularity, peculiarity on its own terms too. Yeah, so David and Jesus might be really different. And that would be good. Understanding those differences might be really healthy, I think, for relations. Yeah, thanks.
See, when you look at the history of some of this, the bad treatment that has been dished out to Jewish people, you know, there's a book called The Sword of Constantine.
Mm-hmm. By James Carroll.
They use a lot of this, right? Not just in recent times, but all the way back into the Middle Ages and beyond. Mm-hmm. I think the problem gets in is if Christians start saying, well, you're wrong, and so we're going to pick on it. Because now we're into a judgmental posture, which is really, at bottom, I think, un-Christian. I can't see Judaism as being as good as Christianity for me, or I might be considering converting to Judaism, which I'm not. Now, for me, at least, I think Christianity is clearly a better choice. But I don't think Christianity gives me a mandate to tell fell down the street who is Jewish that he is wrong and I'm right. I think I have to let it be, work his own way through his struggles. I can't be feeling superior to him somehow, because feeling superior to people and judging people is really not Christian at all.
Yeah, thanks. A couple of piggyback comments here, and then we'll move forward again. James Carroll, that's a terrific book, The Sword of Constantine. Carol is one who, much more than me, I think, would say, once you start with the logic of supersessionism, you're bound to lead to anti-Semitism. That the Holocaust is the kind of natural outworking of this deeply supersessionistic logic. I don't quite buy that. There's lots of other factors, right, that lead to the rise of Nazism and the Third Reich that are not theological in the slightest. And certainly writings that are supersessionistic, including those of Martin Luther, get picked up by the Nazis and are used for propaganda for the treatment of Jews. But I think we can imagine this kind of way of thinking that we can deal with on its own terms without saying, oh, we're all bound to be anti-Semitic. Hopefully it's not that. But Carol will really make the case that once you go down the street, there's no turning around. You're on your way to really bad things.
What's the name of that book?
The Sword of Constantine, or Constantine's Sword, I guess. James Carroll, Constantine's Sword. That's a great, great fat book and really well written.
We need to move on.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh no! I'm sorry. I thought you were telling me to move on.
No, I wanted to say something. I didn't want to interrupt.
No, please.
Well, I feel like Christianity, a problem with our faith is that we don't have a good model for interfaith dialogue. That essentially woven into it is a supersessionistic bent. And you can say that, well, we can still be open-minded towards other faiths, but ultimately there still is a superior attitude, and there is no model for us unless we develop one. Mm-hmm. But there isn't one inherent in the faith that I can see.
Yeah, I mean, there are these, you know, stories in the Gospels.
I mean, you can love them and see there's some good in them, but to say that they're actually equally valid and true as our faith, and to enter into a dialogue of openness that we might be changed from that dialogue, that's not fair.
I am the way, the truth, the life. I mean, I've heard that used against.
And the Gospel is rude, right? It's what he calls a triumphalist theology, and if we have it, then all y'all must not. Back here, and then 2, 3, and then we'll move on. How's that?
I'm just so yearning for that interfaith dialogue, too. And I picked up this book called Abraham. Maybe other people have read it, but it talks about Abraham Salons, Abraham Summits, where we connect over our common ancestors as these three monotheistic religions. I find that really hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of that work going on. But yeah, we don't have a precedent. It's pretty recent.
Probably the most dramatic supersessionists are the Jews for Jesus. They're Jewish, but they convert to they accepted Christianity as the fulfillment of their faith. You know, the other thing about Judaism is that a person is a Jew. There's three different kinds. There's the genetic Jew, that their ancestry is Jewish. The other is the ritualistic Jew that observes all the sacraments, I mean all the traditions, the holidays, things like that. And then there's a religious Jew who, it's more philosophical these days, really, than it is really deeply religious. And, you know, a lot of religious Jews, they go to the temple a couple times a year, and they pay for their seats in the synagogues and things like that. And I had a friend that was Jewish his wife kept a kosher kitchen, but he just couldn't come around, he told me, to accept it. Personal God. He said, yeah, I believe in God, you know, like created the universe and all like that. But he said, I wish I had your faith. And I think it's kind of a hollow religion, really. I mean, it's got a rich tradition. But I think the superstition part is the Jews for Jesus who just followed what God's plan was. God's plan was the Old Testament. All these things over here are not really true, you know. Because, you know, the New Testament credits Abraham as righteous because of his belief. And the other thing, just put this aside, I think one of the worst things that happened to the Christian church was Constantine. You know, he became Christian and made that's the religion.
We'll do a little of this tomorrow, too, when we talk about war. Yeah. Thank you. There's a number of things I'd like to say, but I'll pause here.
One quick one. And then at the risk of tension, Terry Fredheim said that at the other Augustana in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, they held a conference with Islam and Old Testament Judaism and Christians talking about the promises of Abraham. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful dialogue about how each understood those promises.
Yeah. And I think our theme for the summer, right, all the promises of God.
Yes. Sorry. I don't agree with what was just said, but really the word that got me was hollow. I just don't think that goes with the Jewish religion, with the Jewish people.
Yeah. And I too would encourage all of us. I think one way I'm presenting it like this, I'm going to talk about my own upbringing and how I recycle some of these beliefs when I don't think about them. But I think all of us could catch ourselves in impressions we have that are abstracted from a few folks or whatever it might be, and keep our eyes and our ears pointed towards people who are different of us and catch ourselves with painting them in the most favorable terms. I think that's a work of grace. And we're called to do it. Okay, we're going to go on a little bit here and come back. So this is kind of by way of summary now. This would be supersessionism then. We're calling it economic supersessionism. The Old Testament prepares humanity for redemption by pointing forward to Christ in a carnal, meaning bodily and prophetic way. Okay, so the work of the Old Testament is to look to Christ. Luther read the Old Testament as very much of these terms, right? Everything there points forward to Christ. We as Christians might say, heck yes. But we should know that those same scriptures do other things for Jewish folks, too, that we're sharing those texts. Some don't see Jesus in the Old Testament, and those people aren't blind. The New Testament testifies to redemption in Christ in a definitive and spiritual way. In other words, the spiritual church, the Christian church, replaces or displaces carnal, bodily Israel in God's plans. And here I'm borrowing language from another wonderful book by Ken Solon called The God of Israel and Christian Society, Christian Theology. Real quickly, I want to return to this Jews for Jesus motif because Solon deals with it. And he works really closely with a Jewish theologian called Michael Wishkegrad. Wishkegrad is an Orthodox Jew. He's not a Jew for Jesus. He says, I have my covenant. I don't need that covenant. I'm Jewish, not Christian. But he talks a lot about Messianic Jews or Jews for Jesus. And he actually thinks that the real test for supersessionism, this is weird, the real test for supersessionism would be whether your Judaism goes away when you become Christian or whether Jewish converts to Christianities would still keep kosher, would still keep the Torah. He thinks that they should, right? If Judaism goes away when a Jew converts to Christianity, and now I'm Christianity, not Jewish, Wishkegrad says that's the surest sign that you're dealing with a supersessionistic logic, right? That one has displaced the other. He actually thinks if you're a Jew and you convert to Christian, you're no less a Jew now, right? And that you keep kosher, you keep Sabbath, right? And you want to believe in Jesus too, that's fine. But otherwise, you're thinking about Judaism as that which has got to go away once Christianity comes on board. Weird kind of logic, but he plays it out in some really neat ways. One, two.
Well, that's true. Just was an anecdote of my boyhood. My Reverend Moshe Rosen, who founded the Jews for Jesus, it was in my home church in Manuet, New York. And that's exactly his premise. He takes that from his rediscovering the whole richness of Judaism, Jewish Christians from particularly from the Apostle James on. So that exactly is the premise of the Jews for Jesus. They do keep the Torah.
Right.
They do keep
it. Right. And it doesn't mean that Jews are very suspicious of that group, Christians are too, but Wishkegrad is just saying, if you go there, this is how it should play out.
Well, it is fascinating. It's the reverse anti-Semitism from Jews towards them is virulent. It's really the persecution that they've undergone from Jews is just remarkable.
Our doctor is named Goldberg, and he is a Christian. And he told us, we were over there for a Seder dinner one Passover time, and he said when he was a young man and he went through his
bar mitzvah,
he said his uncle...
Is that the music they play?
Bar mitzvah. when his uncle, who was a rabbi in Toronto, came to Chicago for his bar mitzvah, went through the whole process and everything, and then the uncle gave him a Bible, and a New Testament said, now read the rest of the story. So it's...
Yeah, and the first part of the story doesn't go away.
We
Vishkigrad helps others.
They're members of a Christian church and continue Jewish practices. Their children go through bar mitzvah.
As early Christians did as well, right? Paul's question, of course, just to remind, isn't whether or not you stop being Jewish when you become Christian. His question is whether those who aren't Jewish can become Christian. This is all the language of circumcision, right? Do I need to be circumcised before I become baptized? By answering no to that, no, you can become a Christian without being Jewish, doesn't mean that those who come from Judaism to Christianity give up their Judaism. But Paul is sometimes, I think, misunderstood as saying the latter. We won't get too much into that, especially because you all know your Bible better than me. I'm going to skip this part. Besides just saying there's even more subtle forms of supersessionism that are simply the matter of leaving out a big chunk of the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Old Testament. First Testament, we might call it, if we don't like that language of old, if it means outdated. Oftentimes, the Christian story is told in such a way that you begin with creation, first couple chapters of Genesis, you get to the fall, Genesis 3, and then you page ahead, and page ahead, page ahead. Right, and you get to the Gospels, right? Here's creation doctrine, here's humanity mucking it up, and then we need Jesus, right? That leaves out a huge portion, the majority of the Bible, of all the loving acts and judgment and reclaiming Israel, right? That Jews take to be part of their ongoing story. So when Christians tell the Christian story this way and allied this big a chunk of the Bible, we're in maybe dangerous territory. I'm very guilty of this, as I'll say in a second. The better way to think of it, right, would be the covenant is a huge part of God's interaction with God's people. I feel like the whole future nation of Israel is resting on my bladder. We have the corporeal election, it's bodily. Sarah shares with her husband Abraham a tender moment, feeling the wonder of life, right? These are Christian stories. Because we've said that the First Testament is part of our Bible, these are Christian stories, and we ought not tell the Christian story in such a way that we leave them out. Sometimes other Protestants are better than Lutherans here, because Luther's so focused on law and gospel, that we sometimes are prone to hear law as the Old Testament, gospel as the new. Luther didn't do that, actually. He said law and gospel are throughout. Right, all these stories have law and gospel in them, but sometimes we take shortcuts and say law is the early, gospel is the late. I don't think it works. Here's a couple of ways that I've grown up being supersessionistic. In Camp Omega in southern Minnesota, when I was a little kid, I'd sing this song, "Oh, you can't get to heaven, oh, you can't get to heaven, as a Pharisee, as a Pharisee, oh, as a Pharisee, oh, you can't get to heaven as a Pharisee, the Lord don't want no hypocrisy, all my sins are..." Now, you could say that's biblical. Jesus does call the Pharisees hypocrites in more than one of the Gospels, right? In my mind, as a third, fourth, fifth grader, right, Pharisee meant Jewish person, right? There's no distinction. What I knew of Jews was what I knew of Jesus' interactions with fellow Jews in the New Testament, right? And hypocrisy wasn't something about these particular Jews right here and now, these Pharisees, but was something you could abstract, right? So I learned this kind of... this subtle logic that Jews refused Christ and they were hypocritical in doing it. And I just kind of took that on without knowing I was taking it on in a kind of deep sensibility. Even now when I teach Christian theology, Religion 209 is a course I teach all the time, Introduction to Christian Theology. I organize my syllabi, our plans, according to God and creation. We deal a lot with Genesis 1 and 2 there, some of the Psalms as well. Sin and suffering, a lot in Genesis 3. Unit 3, Jesus and Atonement. I need to do a better job, if I'm teaching Christian theology, of saying this covenant stuff is Christian theology and we got to take it really seriously. But I know that the way supersessionism has naturally or inadvertently kind of played itself out in my own kind of assumptions about the Christian story. So here's my question for you. Where else do we see a kind of supersessionistic logic or mentality in our society, in our churches? I hope here that we don't say bad, 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 but yeah, it's here and we need to look at it and deal with it. So would you all turn to one, two, three other folks, someone you trust or don't? Sometimes you don't know, and that's great. You can either speak personally or just, you know, here's a commercial I see, or, you know, something that you hear, and just kind of name some of this, and then we'll maybe get a couple examples as a group. Go ahead. and these conversations continue, but can we hear as a whole group just one, two, three things that we talked about in our smaller groups? Thanks, Jeff.
Well, the finger was pointed back at me when I thought about the conversation in the church about inclusion of gay and lesbian people, something I've been very involved with. And one of the tactics that we've often taken is because Jesus didn't say anything condemning gay people. Therefore, we can dismiss everything in the Old Testament. It doesn't really matter that those things are in there. We don't really have to deal with them. And that is, we've used supersessionism in that way to make an argument for inclusion of gay people.
Yeah. Thanks. We'd never think of that, yes. A way to own up to this. And I hope we can make good case for inclusion of gay and lesbian people.
You can.
It's just harder to go back and do it, but we need to. Good. For the Bible Tells Me So, great film that talks about the Hebrew Bible texts that are sometimes used to be anti-gay. That's just my plug. See it sometimes. It's controversial, but worth thinking about.
I've gone to a Bible study for many years, and we always study something in the New Testament. A few years ago, we started working on the three lessons for the coming Sunday, and so we started reading the Old Testament lessons. And I've had all kinds of questions. You know, I haven't heard of any Pharisees lately. You know, where are they? Yeah. And my pastors don't know.
Well, they don't know a thing.
Pharisees, by the way, I think are the group historically that were most similar to the rabbis. Pharisee is a teacher, a moral teacher in the church. Rabbis play that role. And Jesus, of course, was called a rabbi by his disciples. So in some ways, this dispute between Jesus and the Pharisees is not like Christian versus Jew. It's like the closest form of way of the many different ways to be Jewish at the time, right? We think of it as like this family dispute going on. We tend to catch ourselves in thinking like Christian versus Jew. No, these are two Jews who are very, very close talking about this. Yeah, up here.
Well, about Pharisees as well, I think that oftentimes Pharisees and Sadducees were known for being involved with the Roman Empire.
Right.
And so the reference to hypocrites was that Jesus was calling them hypocrites because they weren't helping their neighbors. Instead, they were in cohorts with the Roman Empire who was, you know, doing all forms of oppression at the time. So.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. Right. And that gets the Romans back in on it, which we need to do as well. Yeah.
Are you mainly talked about, like, the kind of hermeneutic that you take when reading these texts? So, if you are a Christian, you're reading it as a Christian, you're reading it for Christians, maybe even.
Right.
Where is it disrespectful to read Christ into the Hebrew scriptures,
or is it not?
You know, because those writers wrote of a coming Messiah, but not specifically about Christ, obviously.
Right.
You know, then how do we read those texts? You know,
as faithful Christians. I think it's a wonderful question. This is my personal answer. I don't think there's any problem at all at reading the Hebrew Bible and saying it points to Christ as Christians. When you talk about, I know that my Redeemer lives in Job, or promises of the Messiah in Isaiah and everything else, yes, we think of Jesus as fulfilling those messianic expectations, that prophecy. I think what we do at that point then is say, we do that as Christians, and then we understand that somebody might read this text otherwise, and it's not illegitimate, right?
Yeah.
These people aren't blind. This is what Luther got to at the end of his life when he wrote some very vindictive things against Jews. He so much thought that once the Reformation happened, once the gospel was freed from the confines of the church during Luther's days, he thought Jews would just come in droves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Finally, they didn't show up, right? And he got mad. Right? How can you not see that the Hebrew Bible points to Jesus? He couldn't believe it. He thought they were obstinate, and it was a matter of stubborn maliciousness on their part. I think what we have to say is, yes, we see this pointing to Jesus, and we see that for some it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
For some are still waiting for a Messiah. Some believe that the Torah is the Messiah. Right? And it takes some mental durability on their part in saying, I see Jesus, and I see how you don't. Something to that effect. Let's go to some people we haven't heard from yet. All these comments are great.
Yeah.
this is just sort of going off what you said about our, you know, our interpretive structure that we have when we read any part of the Bible. I started spending a lot of time with Orthodox Jews a couple of years ago, and my whole understanding of all of this just did a complete, you know, 360. And the most profound thing that happened is that I started reading the Gospels without a supersessionist assumption, and I started seeing things I'd never seen before. I started seeing Jesus say, not one jot or tittle of the law is going to pass away. Anybody who says that any of the smallest part is not in effect, you know that person is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started seeing him say that the rabbis sit in the seat of Moses, and you need to treat them as such.
Mm-hmm.
And I also started learning about the historical background on a lot of the disputes that we see around, you know, food impurity and washing of hands and things that I think Christians seize upon, and really learning that, in fact, those were simply the debates of the time, you know, how strict we want to be on these issues, and that it doesn't necessarily mean that Jesus himself was saying that the law was not in effect. And so that, just to speak to you, to what you said about the, you know, our hermeneutic of reading these.
Hermeneutic just means a way of interpreting, for those who haven't used that word at the last table yet. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Just adding one more thing on this. I think one thing we can train ourselves to do when we read the Gospels and the letters of Paul is to understand that much of the Christian New Testament is written under Roman rule, right? The temple has been destroyed by the time the rest of the Gospels are either being written or are written. Jews are being persecuted by the Romans. There's this warfare going on. There's Jewish uprisings beginning a few years before the destruction of the temple, and there's a Rome is clamping down. And Christians early on, to preserve their status, very much needed to be part of Judaism. They didn't want to look like an upstart cult, like we're these Jesus freaks, right? You know, respect us. No, we're part of this old tradition that you've respected, you Rome have given some liberties and privileges to. But as soon as Rome starts attacking these Jews, right, these Christians who up to this point have thought of themselves as one good way to be Jewish, say, oh, we're not them, right? And what gets happened as the Gospels are written in some ways is if there's ever a chance to downplay critique of Rome, I think many of the Gospel writers are going to do it. And if there's ever a chance of distinguishing Jesus from the Jews, as they're called in John's Gospel, so the Gospels are going to do it. One way we can teach ourselves to read the Gospels is to say they're written under oppression. These are letters by people who are under imperial rule. You don't say, screw you, Caesar, when you're under imperial rule, right? You say, we're not them, let us live a little bit. That takes a tremendous amount of learning to reread what's happening in the Gospels, and it's not easy work at all. One more comment about what you talked about in these groups, and then we'll go on. Yeah, Dale.
Oh, a very current issue. I have a good friend who is very, very concerned about justice, and I think the promise in his faith is the promised land. And so when we talk about the Palestinian issue, he sees Israel as all right and the Palestinians as all wrong.
Yeah.
And that's a difficulty for me.
Yeah, it is. It is, yeah, and it's hard sometimes when pro-Jewish equates to being pro-Israel to not then be anti-Jewish in order to be a critic of Israel. And many of us find ourselves wanting to say, as Christians, we can be much more pro-Jewish than we have been in the past. That doesn't necessarily mean that Palestinians are the bad guys and we should be pro-Israel in some political imperialistic way. We want to make some really fine-tuned distinctions at that point. Thank you for putting that on the table. That's wonderful. Yes, please.
Just a short one. I'm very interested in kind of the modern cultural expressions of supersessionism, and I think that it also gets mixed in with majoritism,
mm-hmm.
so that now as Christians we are majority, some people would say not, but we are of a background and a bent that is much more Christian than the majority, as a majority. And I'm married to a Jewish man, and you know it becomes much more stark when you're seeing it through somebody else's eyes. So, you know, the most obvious example is the Merry Christmas versus Happy Holidays kind of thing. And I know that's loaded, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But there are lots of other things that just assume that Christianity is what you should assume about anybody and about the culture. And there may be some minor examples where that isn't true, but for the most part it is true. And it's really big if you live in, say, Seattle versus Long Island.
Yeah, right.
Or
St.
Fort Wayne, Indiana versus Seattle.
Yeah.
I think the more rural you go, the more small town America you go, the more you start that contrast is even school holidays. And we were talking about that in women's clinic.
Thanks. So again, this may be one way of talking about majority consciousness too. Remember the theme through the week here, becoming a Christian in Christendom. How can we remind ourselves that Christianity isn't just the overarching name we give to Western civilization? It's something peculiar. How do we develop a minority consciousness, even though numerically we're a majority, right? That's difficult work, but I think part of this is training and doing it.
I was just having sadness about that exact thing, like just a lot of warning that with that ism part, it exists, like that's an institutionalization where I don't even have the eyes to see this happening, and it's just this videotape in my head of, you know, how I am, and I'm not even aware of it, really. And so we were talking, and I thought, I don't even know these things. They're there, and it's not like I don't live with, you know, I have people in my life who are Jewish, and yet, you know, how what they see in their eyes is going to be so much different, and then, again, it's sad of that awareness.
And I join you. Thanks.
One group that does this is the Islam. They think there's superseding the Christianity.
We could have an eye. We'll leave this to Kit.
I don't know.
You could take this word supersessionism and say Christian supersessionism is one form, and you could think about Islam as it reinterprets Judaism and Christianity and thinks of itself in the birth of Islam historically in the 8th century of the Common Era as being supersessionistic as well, sitting upon and replacing those traditions. Although I think you'd want some Muslims in the room to have a conversation. Our job is to do this work, I think. Good. Real quickly, and then we'll get to some final points and comments. I think even more so than in our theologies, we see subtle forms of supersessionism in popular images and other things from mainstream culture. A lot of people are either for or against Gibson's Passion of the Christ. Some things about Gibson is, you know, anti-Semitic, and there's this kind of real charge language. Other people think that this is a very evangelical, emotional film. We, I hope, don't need to decide one way or the other, but I think one thing we can see in this film is that it plays on a kind of supersessionistic mentality. And let me just name a couple of things for those of you who have seen it. For those of you who haven't, it should still make some sense. The film begins with images of Genesis 3, a serpent, and then skips to the last 15, 16 hours of Jesus' life. So it has that structural supersessionism where the context is not Jesus as a Jew, saying Jewish prayers, living the Jewish life, but evil and skip right towards the point of redemption. A marvelous scene at the beginning when Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Mary Magdalene are speaking to one another, and one says to the other, I can't remember which way it was, how is this night different from all the other nights? Does anyone know what that line is taken from? First lines of the Seder meal, right? A very ritualistic saying that would be answered in very ritualistic ways. This night is different because before we were slaves and we are slaves no longer. That's a bad translation or my own paraphrasing. Instead, the other answers, I don't know if there is an answer, but we get a vision of Jesus cutting in. So in some ways that film is taking this Jewish ritual and they're saying it points automatically. Why is this night different? Because Jesus is getting crucified. Now again, that could be good Christian theology. That night is different for Christians. But it's dangerously close to saying Judaism as a ritual here ends, and this night is different now because it's the birth of Christianity. I don't know. I may be reading too much into that, but I'm reading less into the images of Jewish folks here. The Jewish leaders are painted in the most wooden way possible, I think, throughout this film. We barely see their profiles. They're always dressed like this, heavily clad, which may be accurate to the time, but we know that Jesus in that film isn't. Never wears a prayer shawl. He's in Garden of Gethsemane. Good Jew praying to God before his death is going to wear a prayer shawl and say Jewish prayers, right? Jesus looks like a good, upstanding, upper middle class Christian in a way that the Jews certainly don't in this film. And I think the film is subtly playing off that difference. And it comes out especially clear when you compare them to Rome. Pontius Pilate, I think, looks, again, someone I'd like to be my uncle in some ways. Rome gets off pretty easily in this film, and the Jews come out not as just the real bad guys, but as a particular kind of bad, a real cold, calculating, ritualistic, this wooden kind of malice, calculated malice. So I don't know how much of a point we want to make there, but I do think that some things in popular culture get us towards a supersessionistic mentality. We'll close with this. This is a statement from the Lutheran Church in the 1990s. Many church bodies, including Catholicism, ELCA Church, and others, have rejected supersessionism, and Lutherans have paid particular attention to the role of Luther's writings in the rise of Nazism in the Second World War. This is from an ELCA document that says, "In her rejection of every persecution against any man, the Church, mindful of the patrimony she shares with the Jews and moved not by political reasons, but by the gospel's spiritual love, decries hatred, persecution, displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews at any time and by anyone." Sorry, that was from the Catholic Church. This is what I wanted to end with. I think that this language is really powerful, and it gets back to an early comment. Grieving the complicity of our own tradition, within this history of hatred, moreover, we express our urgent desire to live out our faith in Jesus Christ with love and respect for the Jewish people. We recognize an anti-Semitism, I think we could say anti-Judaism or supersessionism there, a contradiction and an affront to the gospel, a violation of our hope and calling. And we pledge this church to oppose the deadly workings of such bigotry, both within our own circles and in the society around us. That contradiction, to repeat the very wise comment earlier, if God can take back God's promises, calling of the Jewish people as God's chosen people, that covenant, if God would and does do such a thing, aren't we resting on a promise that's shaky, right? When is God going to reject God's promise to the church? That we see God fully revealed in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. I think Christians have a lot of self-incentive, not in a selfish way, but good self-incentive to say, God doesn't go back on God's promises. God is with the Jews in their covenant because God is with Christians in a second covenant, a new covenant. And that Christians, as Christians, need to stand up and say God doesn't go back because we hold on to the promises of God just as much as the Jews do. Thanks for your time. Sorry to go a couple minutes over.